Chapter 8. We the Electorate. Who will govern the governors? There is only one force in the nation that can be depended upon to keep the government pure and the governors honest, and that is the people themselves. Thomas Jefferson. The verdict is in. Despite some accomplishments, it's evident Donald Trump is behaving immorally, weakening the party he professes to lead, undermining democratic institutions, abandoning crucial U.S. alliances, emboldening our adversaries, dividing Americans with hateful rhetoric and chronic dishonesty, and surrounding himself with people who will only reinforce his defects. It was easy to dismiss a pile of insider accounts about the severity of the situation. However, the pile is now a mountain, and the stories paint the portrait of a leader who handles the nation's affairs with persistent negligence. Donald Trump deserves to be fired. Yes, top officials have frequently hit the brakes to forestall disastrous presidential decisions. But as I noted in the beginning of this book, my original thesis in the New York Times was dead wrong. Americans should not expect that his advisors can fix the situation. We cannot. The question is, what to do next? There are good and bad approaches for handling the historic leadership failures emanating from the executive office of the president. We must address the second category first. Firing a president. A psychological phenomenon is affecting a large portion of the country. Some call it Trump Derangement Syndrome, TDS. If this were a clinical diagnosis, it would best be characterized as the disturbance in normal cognitive function resulting in irrational animus toward the President of the United States. Said differently, people who hate Trump so much that they can't think straight. There is no doubt President Donald Trump is living rent-free in all of our heads. He occupies more daily mindshare, argument, and concern for the average American than any prior chief executive. But feverish consternation about a president shouldn't lead us to automatically pursue drastic measures. Those who suffer from TDS have had dark fantasies for years about how Trump's tenure can be cut short. They've imagined he will be forced to resign for doing something so terrible that it shocks the conscience of the nation. They've prayed his cabinet will evict him by invoking emergency constitutional provisions. They've yearned for him to be impeached and removed by the U.S. Congress, or they've had other disgraceful thoughts that don't merit discussion whatsoever, but which perhaps deserve a visit from the U.S. Secret Service. On this score, I want to speak to Trump's political opponents and his harshest critics, the ones who want him thrown out of office at any cost. I understand your frustration. I, too, have developed strong opinions about the president's performance and whether he deserves to continue leading our great nation. But when we engage in careless speculation about the president's ouster, we are promoting a level of anti-democratic behavior on par with the conduct for which we are criticizing Trump. It's time to restate the obvious. Although Donald Trump is undoubtedly prone to contemptible behavior, we should not wish upon our nation the crisis of premature presidential expulsion. It might be how the story ends, but we must be reluctant to fire a president in non-electoral ways and should only consider doing so as an absolute last resort. First, let's start with terrible misdeeds. Some people hope the president will do something so awful that he must resign immediately in the face of widespread popular discontent. A few senior members of Trump's team privately imagined the possibility. As one said, the president's inclinations are so bad that perhaps we should give him enough rope to entangle his own presidency. This wouldn't be hard. He is a factory that produces a steady stream of presidency-wrecking ideas. In that case, the advisor suggested letting him fire the special counsel and Justice Department leadership. He seemed eager enough to do it. If aides helped him follow his instincts, they speculated, it would lead to his downfall. I find the proposition disturbing on its face. While the president has unquestionably engaged in conduct that is detrimental to our country, we should never encourage bad behavior only so we can punish it. For that reason, no one, to my knowledge, considered instigating such an outcome beyond making thoughtless comments. Steady staters, or what's left of the group, feel obligated to keep the presidency on the rails and to dissuade Trump from taking self-destructive actions. The country deserves nothing less. To permit a wrong, or to encourage one, is to be culpable in it. For the health of our republic, we should never long for our president to act egregiously enough to inspire bipartisan masses to demand resignation. Second, the 25th Amendment. Although this is a dreadful idea, the concept was informally broached in conversations in Washington's halls of power. Trump's behavior became so erratic in the weeks following Jim Comey's firing and the appointment of the special counsel that a number of senior administration officials worried about his mental state. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein reportedly considered wearing a wire to his West Wing meetings to document the madness in the president's White House. Within days of Trump's fire Mueller demands, others in the administration were having the same quiet conversations. They asked themselves, is the president still fit for office? The 25th Amendment is a constitutional provision that deals with presidential succession in cases of resignation, removal, incapacitation, or death. Specifically, Trump administration officials honed in on Section 4. Whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or of such other body as Congress may by law provide, transmit to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives their written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the vice president shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office as acting president. In short, if Vice President Pence and a majority of the cabinet felt that Trump could no longer discharge his duties, they could remove him from office. To be clear, this was not an action the president's cabinet was preparing or prepared to take. However, the disarray was so severe, and concern about Trump's temperament so pervasive, that his lieutenants talked about what would happen if the situation got worse. This included comparing notes on a breaking point. What level of instability warranted presidential removal? Was it debilitating cognitive impairment? Was it a reckless order that put the American people in danger? There's no handbook for these situations. A back-of-the-envelope whip count was conducted of officials who were most concerned about the deteriorating situation. Names of cabinet-level officials were placed on a mental list. These were folks who, in the worst-case scenario, would be amenable to huddling discreetly in order to assess how bad the situation was getting. Any discussion of the 25th Amendment was hushed and fleeting, because almost everyone concluded it was irresponsible to speculate about it at all. I froze when I first heard someone suggest that we might be getting into 25th territory. That's pretty scary talk, I thought. At home that night, I imagined how the hypothetical scenario would play out. The majority of the cabinet would probably meet somewhere in secret, away from the White House. They would draft a letter to the leaders of Congress, certifying the president was unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. Those gathered around the table would take a deep breath and pass the pen in silence, each signing a document they knew would become one of the most consequential in U.S. history. Once the majority of the cabinet signed, someone would pass a message to the vice president. He would be waiting elsewhere until he was certain there was sufficient support. Then he would make his choice. Mike Pence holds his cards close when it comes to his opinions about Trump, but if a majority of the cabinet was prepared to remove the president and elevate Pence, if the emergency was that serious, there is no doubt what he'd do. He would affix his name to the paper. Everyone would feel the gravity of the moment in their gut. Armored vehicles would race across town to the U.S. Capitol building, and a protected courier would walk the document into the hands of congressional leaders. As I contemplated this scenario, that unwelcome visitor in the Trump administration, reason, took over. I thought, and then what? President Trump would stroll out of the White House, take a bow, and get on a helicopter to head home? Doubtful. If the story didn't already sound like a B-movie, this is where it would become a horror film. Removal of the president by his own cabinet would be perceived as a coup. The end result would be unrest in the United States, the likes of which we haven't seen since maybe the Civil War. Millions would not accept the outcome, perhaps including the president himself, and many would take to the streets on both sides. Violence would be almost inevitable. The ensuing strife would break us for years to come. Among other good reasons, that is why the option was not seriously contemplated. The whispered conversations about the 25th ceased, though concerns about the president's temperament have remained. Trump's critics would be smart to drop the idea, too. They should keep such fantasies to themselves, lest they further poison our already toxic discourse. In a democracy, we don't overthrow our leaders when they're underperforming. That's for third-rate banana republics and police states. The 25th Amendment should be reserved for scenarios when the commander-in-chief is truly unable to discharge his duties, not when we are dissatisfied with his performance. Third, impeachment. As of this writing, we are living through the prospect. We should not relish it. Impeachment inquiries are painful for the country and our political system, as history has shown. We must refrain from politicizing the impeachment process by letting frustration with Trump cloud our judgment about the facts. Much of the evidence of wrongdoing is disturbing, from the president urging Ukraine to investigate one of his political rivals to examples of Trump's efforts to improperly influence the Russia investigation. It is the job of Congress to consider whether these actions rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors and whether they justify Trump's removal from office. It's un-American to hope our president is guilty of high crimes. Wishing the president to be branded a criminal and booted prematurely from office means wishing ever greater division upon the United States. We can scarcely afford further disunion. That's why we must put aside our passions and allow the exercise to run its course. We should demand that our representatives approach the deliberations soberly, without political malice. An impeachment motivated by public anger above truth would set a precedent far worse than whatever poor conduct it sought to remedy. Democrats in Congress should not rush to judgment, and they are obligated to run a fair process in the House. Similarly, if the evidence points to criminality, Republicans must not resist justice because it is politically inconvenient. They must follow the facts where they lead. While I cannot discuss the specifics surrounding the present allegations against the president involving Ukraine beyond what is in the public record, as a general proposition, it should not surprise anyone that Donald Trump would act in a manner that is unbecoming of his office and possibly disqualifying. He has always acted impulsively to serve his interests over those of the United States. As I've noted, he has repeatedly concocted ways to break the law if it gets him what he wants. More stories remain to be told and will come out in the months and years ahead. His ideas are often resisted, but they prove that Trump is indifferent to the reasons why presidents shouldn't abuse their power for personal gain. When he is warned about the propriety or legality of his proposals, he is agitated, to the point that he has pushed out many of the senior people who've tried to protect him. He has few guardrails left. More worrisome, re-election will convince him he is freer than ever to put his self-interest above the national interest. Donald Trump's record is troubling. At some point, aspects of it might be found to have violated his oath of office. Unless and until that happens, though, all of the previously mentioned courses of action are undesirable ways to fire a president. One option, and one option only, stands above the rest as the ultimate way to hold Trump accountable. The people themselves. In an anonymous essay designed to whip up support for the draft of the U.S. Constitution, Alexander Hamilton wrote, "The executive should be independent for his continuance in office on all but the people themselves. No other political force should decide whether he stays or goes, save for exceptional circumstances. There is a single right way, prescribed by the architects of this country, for holding our leaders to account. It is as elegant as it is blunt. It is the transmission line for all power in our political system, determining who gains, retains, and loses authority. It is the election. The people are the best and most legitimate recourse for our present political dilemma. The democratic process exists for this very purpose, and we rely on transparent public debate and the popular will to keep leaders in check. The voters must review the president's conduct and decide whether Donald Trump is fit for office, whether he embodies the American spirit, and whether we will allow the behavior of one man to define us as a whole. The solemn responsibility rests with each of us. By definition, an electorate is the sum of the people in a nation entitled to vote. In the United States, approximately 75% of the population is of voting age, but turnout tends to be closer to 50%. That means in our upcoming and highly contested presidential race, half of the country will make a momentous decision for the others. One half will define us all. We must remember that we are whom we elect. Like man, like state, Plato wrote 2 millennia ago. Governments vary as the characters of men vary. States are made out of the human natures which are in them. The government of the United States is whatever it is because the people are whatever they are. The nature of one man, the president, is not what shapes the collective attributes of a nation. It is the other way around. Our views, our aspirations, and our morality are what define the republic and are meant to be reflected by the people we elect. On voting day, we will have had 4 years to make up our minds about Donald Trump. Entering the booth, there will be many factors to weigh when considering whether to re-elect him to the presidency. Is he more qualified than the others? Is he offering a more compelling agenda? Has he demonstrated a record of success? As we stare at our secret ballots, the most important question of all will be, does he reflect us? There are several ways to answer the question. The first is, yes, he does. Donald Trump reflects our nation, and therefore the choice is obvious. The voter will seek to re-elect him. He's the right guy for the job. The second is, no, he doesn't. If during one term in office, Trump has fallen short of our standards and doesn't faithfully reflect our values, there is a chance to course correct. The electoral process doesn't pronounce a final sentence. It offers the chance to fix mistakes. The voter will choose someone else. There is a third answer, though. Yes, he does, but it's not acceptable. A voter may conclude that Donald Trump's roller coaster presidency is a faithful representation of what is happening in our society. They may argue that the 2016 presidential election resulted in the elevation of a man who embodied our country's internal strife. His measure of wisdom, justice, courage, and temperance is a strong indicator of whether we are demonstrating those traits ourselves. Yet that doesn't mean we have to submit to the malaise. We can admit that, Although we ended up with the president we deserved the first time, we want better. A single election will not change who we are, but it can signal that we intend to go a new direction. It's only a first step. In the conclusion of this book, we will talk about the more urgent repairs needed under the hood of our republic. For now, any rehabilitation of we the people can begin with a declarative statement of change from we the electorate. In an odd way, an even bigger worry for our republic is what may happen if Trump is removed from office by impeachment or a narrow defeat in the ballot box, and he refuses to go. In the beginning of the administration, I could see a man still in awe that he was sitting in the Oval Office, struggling to play the role of president. No conversation was too distant from the 2016 election, and how, in his view, it was nearly stolen from him. Deep down, there was a nagging insecurity that maybe he didn't belong there. It was one reason why few dared to bring up Russia's indisputable interference on his behalf in the election. But he quickly grew accustomed to the trappings of power, the ability to summon servants or Diet Cokes with the push of a button, to show the majesty of the Oval Office to visitors, to bellow orders and expect them to be followed. Trump relishes the cocoon he has built. He will not exit quietly or easily. It is why at many turns he suggests coups are afoot and a civil war is in the offing. He is already seeding the narrative for his followers, a narrative that could end tragically. Our moment for this conversation is now. We will lose all hope of having a real dialogue within ourselves and with our neighbors in the immediate run-up to Election Day. Rationality will be locked away at that point, and our judgment will be clouded by emotion. It's always been this way in our system. If we consider our national character and that of our current president in advance of voting, it will inform how we react in the heat of that moment. It may temper our factionalism during the race. Hopefully, it will prevent us from making self-destructive choices on the ballot. However, it will get harder by the day. The president is already attempting to intimidate voters based on cynicism and fear. With his trademark sarcasm, he is gingerly assigning comical call signs to his opponents to turn off independent voters. Trump also wants middle-of-the-road Americans to be afraid to go in a new direction. "If you don't support me, you're going to be so goddamn poor," he bellowed at a campaign rally, suggesting economic ruin without him. It's become a refrain. "You have no choice but to vote for me," the president told another group of supporters, "because your 401k, everything is going to be down the tubes. So whether you love me or hate me, you gotta vote for me." We can't cave to Trump's elementary logic that there's no choice but to vote for him. He should be fired. And it's time to take stock of our options for his replacement. The Devil We Don't Know. I cannot overstate the consequences of re-electing Donald Trump. I've seen the impact of his leadership on our government and country up close and all too personal. The Trump administration is an unmitigated catastrophe. And the responsibility rests entirely at his feet, the predictable outcome of assigning organizational leadership to a man of weak morals. What is more regrettable is that his faults are amplifying our own. I believe firmly that whatever benefits we may have gained from individual Trump policies are vastly outweighed by the incalculable damage he has done to the fabric of our republic. I cannot yet say who will turn the ship, but 4 more years of Trump could very well sink it. There is something else to consider about the next 4 years. How lucky we have been to avoid a monumental international crisis since Trump took office. We have not suffered a major attack against the United States or been forced to go to war, but it's only a matter of time before that luck runs out. Those of you tempted to vote to re-elect Donald Trump, despite the scandals and despite credible evidence of wrongdoing, might want to consider what could happen when that crisis comes. Do we want to keep our nuclear arsenal and our nation's military under the stewardship of a man who ignores intelligence briefings, who puts his self-interest ahead of the country's needs during international engagements, who enjoys the company of foreign thugs, who our enemies think is a fool they can manipulate, who has shunned our friends, whose credibility has been shattered, and who our national security leaders no longer trust? Consider it. Fortunately, there are already candidates in the race who are more honorable than the current president and stable enough to handle the demands of the presidency. With luck, the field will widen to include other public figures who appeal to both sides of our polarized electorate. I will not endorse a particular person. Every voter needs to make up his or her own mind. We don't know what the final ballot will look like, which will impact every man's and woman's considerations, but the essential point is that we cannot be afraid to make a change. Even still, the choice will not be easy for my fellow Republicans. The race is likely to come down to two candidates. Republicans will face a trade-off. Pick the devil I know, Donald Trump, whose views align more closely with mine, but whose moral code is visibly compromised, or pick the devil I don't, a Democrat, who will fight for policies I disagree with, but is probably a more decent person. Last time around, ideology tipped the balance over temperament. A semi-Republican Trump was better than a hardcore Democrat Clinton, the thinking went. This time, Republican voters should reconsider their math. I'm not saying it's desirable for our party to lose the White House. Most Republicans won't support the Democratic alternative to Trump. But if the other side does win, Republicans shouldn't be fearful of becoming the opposition party. It's easier to fix mistakes wrought by bad policies than those wrought by bad people. Conservatives generally respected former President Obama as a family man, but despised his agenda. In the end, a number of his initiatives were reversed as easily as the executive orders it took to establish them. Trump, on the other hand, has done far more damage because of his true nature. His innate flaws are the dark side of his legacy. They have cut to the core of our political institutions and civic life with long-lasting effects. We'd be better off as a party opposing the agenda of a weak president from the outside than apologizing for one from within. Besides, the last time Republicans were in the opposition, the GOP got pretty damn good at it. Nevertheless, the counterargument to my point will be strong if the Democratic Party nominates someone deeply out of touch with mainstream America. Then everything changes. If it's one of the Democratic candidates preaching socialism, Trump's fear-mongering will still be persuasive. Republicans will argue that the other candidate, as president, would attack our free market principles, tax us into economic recession, promote a thought police culture of political correctness, fan the flames of identity politics, and bring government into our lives like never before. It will be a repeat of 2016. Compared to the leftward lurching Democratic Party, Trump will seem friendlier to conservative ideals. Discussions about qualifications will give way to emotion and fear, and Trump's re-election chances will rise. Democrats listening to this book know how high the stakes are. I implore you, if you want a majority of our nation to reject Donald Trump, you must show wisdom and restraint in selecting your party's nominee. Resist the temptation to swerve away from the mainstream. Trust me, we flirted with extremes in the GOP during the last cycle, and look where it got us. If Democrats do the same, Trump will be that much closer to a second term and better equipped to convince Americans to stick with him. If, however, you nominate someone who campaigns on unity instead of ideological purity, you will have a sizable number of Republicans and independents ready to make common cause. Trump or an unnamed Democrat are not our only options. If we had courage, the Republican Party would seriously consider replacing President Trump at the top of the ticket. I know firsthand that leading GOP officials would like to dump the president if there was a strong candidate willing to step forward. They talk about it behind closed doors. Many Republican senators and congressmen are itching for someone else, despite the fact that they pay homage in public to the current occupant of the Oval Office. Some former Republican officeholders have announced primary challenges to the president. More may throw their hats into the ring before this is published. These candidates have obvious shortcomings, but Republicans should ask themselves, are those shortcomings more numerous than those our commander-in-chief has displayed already? Not by a mile, which is why the alternatives to Trump should be taken seriously. In the end, if the Republican Party refuses to stand up to the president, and if the Democratic Party cannot nominate a candidate that appeals to both sides of our divided society, then we are in dire need of a leader bold enough to break the two-party system. There is an opening for an independent candidate ready to put country before party. He or she should be a leader whose platform is America's common ground, not one of the respective tribal camps in U.S. politics. A credible third-party candidate will find support from silent Republicans eager for an alternative, Democrats uninspired by their field, and independents desperate to break free of this mess. Americans worried about a second term of Donald Trump have another choice on Election Day I've not yet mentioned. There is one final option for preventing him from wreaking havoc for another 4 years if he's reelected. It's an insurance policy, and it will be right in front of you when you step into the voting booth. Look down. Democracy's next best safeguard is the rest of the ballot. You will have a slate of aspiring public officials to choose from who can hold the U.S. government accountable. Don't focus solely on your pick for the nation's highest office and play roulette with the rest of the candidates running for the U.S. Senate, the House, state offices, and so on. You must consider which of these people are ready to lead. Are they prepared to keep the president and our executive branch in check? Will they be unafraid to speak the truth? Do they have the honorableness and decency that have become endangered traits in today's politics? If we exercise good judgment on the rest of the ballot, we can better protect our country's institutions and its future. No matter what happens on Tuesday, November 3rd, 2020, Americans have another pressing review to conduct. It's bigger than a presidential election. This particular duty doesn't involve weighing individual candidates or anyone running for public office, for that matter. The task at hand is to judge someone far more important than the commander-in-chief, someone who will be illuminated by the national spotlight whether or not Donald Trump is reelected. Ourselves. The time has come to assess the civic fault lines spreading across our republic. The character of one man has widened the chasms of American political division. But if any good comes from the turmoil, hopefully it will be that it causes us to reinvestigate and reinvigorate the character of our nation. Epilogue. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic chords of memory will swell when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. Abraham Lincoln. Let's roll. Those were Todd Beamer's final words before he set down the phone. Todd was an account manager for a computer company and his early morning business trip came on the heels of a 5-day vacation in Italy. He and his wife had just returned the night before. Rather than take off immediately to his next destination, he spent the evening at home with her and their 2 children. Now, Todd was mid-air on the way from Newark to San Francisco, and his plane had just been hijacked. About 45 minutes into the flight, 4 men stormed the cockpit, slitting the throats of the pilots and taking over the aircraft. One of them made an announcement over the intercom in broken English. "Ladies and gentlemen, hear the captain. Please sit down. Keep remaining seating. We have a bomb on board, so sit." They herded passengers into the rear of the jet and banked back toward the East Coast. Todd tried to use the seat phone and was connected with Lisa Jefferson, a call center representative for the in-flight phone company. He calmly described the scene for her to relay to authorities. The men had knives out. One appeared to have a bomb strapped to his body. The pilots were lying motionless on the floor. A fellow passenger had been killed. Todd's seatmates received word via calls to loved ones that the World Trade Center and the Pentagon had been struck by hijacked airplanes. The passengers and crew huddled to discuss the situation. They didn't want to be the next aircraft flown into a target, so they took a vote and agreed to retake the cockpit. Todd informed Lisa, who was still on the line, that they planned to wrest control of the plane back from the hijackers. He asked her to do him a favor. If he didn't survive, he wanted her to call his wife with a message. "Tell her I love her and the boys." She promised she would. But what Todd would never know was that his wife was pregnant with a baby girl, too. He recited the Lord's Prayer and Psalm 23. "You ready?" he asked fellow passengers. "Okay, let's roll." They rushed the front of the plane. A few minutes later, after a struggle in the cockpit, United Flight 93 crashed into an open field in Somerset County, Pennsylvania, about 20 minutes flying time from Washington, D.C. All souls on board perished. The story of Flight 93 filled Americans with solemn pride in the painful days after the attacks of September 11, 2001. In the face of terror, the passengers displayed moving bravery. These everyday heroes undoubtedly saved many lives, diverting an airplane before it could become a missile, one that was reportedly bound for the U.S. Capitol building. Theirs was the true American spirit, and it far eclipsed the cowardice that briefly controlled the skies that fateful morning. In the aftermath, the words of Todd Beamer became a rallying cry for a more united country. Most recall the months after 9/11 as a period of patriotic renewal in the United States. We flew flags outside our homes. We held our families closer. We felt an unspoken connection to strangers like never before, simply because they were fellow Americans. The sudden embrace of unity over division was not inevitable, as less than a year earlier the nation was split by one of the most fiercely contested elections in history. But after the attacks, we consciously put aside our differences, a collective act facilitated in part by a president's unifying rhetoric. In an address before Congress on September 20, 2011, President Bush stoked the embers of a common bond, telling Americans we would come together against the threat of violence from terrorists. "We will not tire, we will not falter, and we will not fail." Now, imagine the scenario played out differently. Pretend that instead of resolve, Bush expressed skepticism after 9/11. Imagine that, as smoke rose from the Twin Towers, he questioned whether Al-Qaeda really orchestrated the attacks. He dismissed the intelligence community's conclusions as ridiculous. He suggested the hijackers on Todd Beamer's flight could have been from a lot of different groups. He fanned the flames of conspiracy theory by calling the incident a hoax and a ruse. He declared at a press conference, "Osama bin Laden says it's not al-Qaeda. I don't see why it would be," in response to increasingly irrefutable evidence of the terror group's responsibility. And he urged Americans that it would be a mistake to go after al-Qaeda because the United States had the potential for a great relationship with them. If that's what Bush had done, the political explosion would have torn the country to shreds. That's effectively what happened when the United States was attacked in 2016. This time, the hijackers were hackers, and the president was Donald Trump. After Russia's deliberate and coordinated assault on U.S. Democratic elections, recall that Trump downplayed the incident and dismissed the intelligence community's conclusions. He questioned whether the interference was perpetrated by Moscow. He speculated that others could have been behind it. He promoted conspiracy theories. He said he believed Putin's word that Russia was not responsible. And he suggested it would be a mistake for the United States to ruin the possibility of a good relationship with Moscow over the matter. The collective national reaction was not the patriotism, unity, and resolve of 9/11. It was internal conflict, and in the meantime, the Russians got away with it. The two attacks reveal a lot about our choices. In both cases, our enemies wanted to spark chaos in our democracy. In both cases, we had the option to let them or not. I wish the passengers of Flight 93 could have seen the influence of their example upon the country in the first instance, how their courage on 9/11 became a metaphor for American determination. They would have been proud that we chose to come together rather than allow terrorism to rip us apart. I also suspect they would be dismayed to witness our equal capacity for divisiveness not even 2 decades after their noble sacrifice. One might blame Trump for provoking widespread discontent instead of cohesion after Russia's interference. Go ahead and re-listen to the previous paragraph. It's still stunning to recall that this was the president's reaction. Ultimately, though, it was our choice whether to follow his lead. We decided to indulge in irrational speculation. We decided to engage in social media warfare. We decided to alienate neighbors based on whether they agreed with Trump or not. Our response to the attack led to record levels of incivility. The episode shows us why we need to broaden the national conversation beyond electoral politics. The 2020 election cycle is important and will no doubt weigh heavily on our future one way or another. But if we want to remedy our political strife in the long run, it will not happen with a single election day. The problem is much bigger than that, and the solution is not in Washington, D.C. Donald Trump got elected on the idea that our nation's capital was broken and needed a disruptor like him. "I will make our government honest again, believe me. But first I'm going to have to hashtag drain the swamp in D.C., he tweeted on October 18, 2016, the first time he deployed a phrase that became a regular mantra. From Ronald Reagan to Nancy Pelosi, politicians have promised to drain the swamp, a metaphor for fixing our nation's capital and getting corruption out of politics. The phrase is doubly misleading. First, it's a popular misconception that Washington, D.C. was built on a swamp. It was not. And second, the metaphor presupposes our political problems are Washington-centric. The complaint that Washington is broken is almost as old as our capital city itself. Little more than a decade after the U.S. Constitution was ratified, the town was beset with rancorous political infighting. Observers lamented the spectacle of a perpetual struggle between the two parties, epitomized by the toxic election of 1800. "Neither reason nor justice can be expected from either side," wrote one observer, noting that personal resentments were rampant in America's political center. Unlike our symbolic gunfights in politics today, the acrimony was so bad that it led to literal gunfights. Vice President Aaron Burr shot and killed Alexander Hamilton in an 1804 duel, in part due to simmering anger from the disputed election 4 years prior. If that wasn't enough to increase public disgust with Washington politicians, Burr was later arrested and indicted for treason after allegedly conspiring with fellow politicians, military officers, and foreign officials to create a breakaway republic in the center of North America. It's difficult to envision something as galling today as Mike Pence or Joe Biden devising a covert secession campaign to create their own country. The only blip on the radar of discontent with Washington appears to be James Monroe's presidency, 1817 to 1825. These years are known as the Era of Good Feelings, in part because the two-party system was nearly abolished and the nation's capital was led by a single-party government, the Democratic Republicans. Americans were happy with their elected leaders, so much so that President Monroe ran for re-election effectively unopposed, something that hasn't happened since. But the good feelings were fleeting, as the issues of slavery and territorial expansion quickly polarized Washington before he left office. Today, the brokenness of the nation's capital is broadly accepted as a fact of life. People believe that elected officials spend too much time bickering and too little time governing. They lament the nastiness of political campaigns, the constant grandstanding, the revolving door between government agencies and industry, and the fact that compromise has become a relic of the past. You have heard it a million times before and said it yourself. They can't get anything done. Public trust in our government is stuck at all-time lows. A mere 17% of Americans believe they can count on Washington politicians to do what is right just about always or most of the time, according to one poll. A vast majority of Americans, 75%, disapprove of the job Congress is doing. Pollsters have cleverly demonstrated that the legislative body is less popular than root canals, cockroaches, and used car salesmen. Hence, calls to drain the swamp resonate widely. The only branch of government with majority approval right now is the one led by unelected officials, the U.S. Supreme Court. Americans do not need to grasp blindly in the dark to find the boogeyman that is haunting our civic lives. We need only to look in the mirror. Our representatives are not the source of Washington's problems. We are the ones who pick them. If you can give the founders credit for anything, the democratic system reflects the public mood. When we are willing to compromise, our representatives are too. When we are angry and unyielding, partisan and greedy, they will display the same traits. As a result, we are getting the presidency we deserve and the Congress we deserve. Is it not obvious that elected leaders are mimicking our behavior? Their snarky attacks and Twitter jabs sound a lot like the messages we send, the comments we make below news articles, and the condescending memes we post to Facebook. Because it's easier to fire rounds from behind a digital wall than hash out problems face to face. It's no wonder people think Washington is broken. We are broken. Traveling America in the 1830s, Frenchman Alexis de Tocqueville observed, "In America, the president exerts a very great influence on affairs of state, but he does not conduct them. The preponderant power resides in the national representation as a whole. It is therefore the mass of people that must change, and not only the president, in order that the maxims of politics vary. We can drain the swamp if we want by firing Donald Trump and electing a new Congress. I strongly believe the first action will make a difference. But lasting change will require deeper, nationwide self-reflection. It will require us to alter ourselves, to consider who we were, who we are, and who we want to be. De Tocqueville noted during his visit to the United States that the people he encountered really knew what it meant to be citizens. "Ask any American about their country," he wrote, "and the person will teach you about their rights, duties, and the law." He marveled at how we derived our knowledge not from books, but from firsthand experience. "It is from participating in legislation that the American learns to know the laws, from governing that he instructs himself in the form of government. The great work of society is accomplished daily before his eyes and, so to speak, in his hands." An observer would be hard-pressed to say the same about us today. The United States is an exceptional nation, but it could soon run the risk of civic moral bankruptcy, the consequence of losing touch with history. The majority of Americans are unable to pass basic civics exams and know far too little about our past and our form of government. Many of us can't name our congressman or state representative, let alone describe principles such as habeas corpus or popular sovereignty. We have forgotten about the world we built yesterday. Now our tomorrow is in doubt. There are two choices. We can either bury our heads in the sand, hoping it gets better by itself, or we can recognize the situation for what it is, and rather than allow political turmoil to hasten our demise, begin a restoration. It's time to start searching for guideposts to rejuvenate public life. We need a civic renaissance for our day and age. That's how we'll right the ship. It requires dusting off the lessons of our forebears, updating them for the modern world, and reinvigorating active participation in our civic life. The topic itself deserves a separate book entirely. To start with, we need to restore a climate of truth by clearing the air of misinformation and changing how we report, consume, and share news so we aren't living in different realities. We must also relearn the art of agreeing to disagree with people whose political views we don't share rather than alienating them. If we escape our echo chambers, it will make it easier to cooperate on issues large and small. It's likewise important for us to begin reassociating in person. Our proclivity to participate in voluntary organizations was long a defining aspect of the American story. And we've been called a nation of joiners, a trait that has allowed us to develop a democratic culture unlike any other. Sadly, our growing interconnectedness online is making us disconnected from one another, so we must find new ways to engage. Additionally, it's time to bring the focus of politics closer to home. Our problems won't be solved with one-size-fits-all DC fixes. Washington is slow and cumbersome, and we don't have to wait for it to act. We can have a faster and deeper impact on the issues we care about, health care, crime, or drug use, by acting within our communities today. At the same time, it's incumbent upon us to focus on educating the next generation about their democracy. I will never forget one of my first U.S. history classes. My teacher was a veteran who had fought in the war, had scars to show for it, and ran a tight ship in the classroom. One day I got in trouble for interrupting another student. "Damn it," my teacher said, silencing the classroom. "Apologize now. Now." I apologized to my fellow student, but the teacher told me I also owed an apology to Thomas Paine, the American revolutionary whose writings we were studying. "That and much more," he said. What else do I owe him, sir?" I added, probably to a few chuckles. He stared me straight in the eyes and said two words I will never forget. "Your life." Our job as citizens is twofold. We need to preserve the Republic for ourselves and get ready to pass it along. It won't be in our custody forever. There's a U.S. senator in Washington fond of the saying, "When you're going down a dirt road and see a turtle atop a fence post, chances are that turtle didn't get there by itself." Our country has been saved time and time again by the generations that picked us up before we could get run over. Now it's our turn to do the same for the next generation. We need to get serious about preparing our children for the biggest job title they'll ever have, citizen. It's no exaggeration to suggest, as my teacher once did, that our very lives depend on it. America's past is its lodestar. Every lesson we need for renewing our country is there, waiting to be rediscovered. The shared values around which it was founded are the true north that united the states, and to which we must return to preserve our future. The survival of our democracy is not inevitable. Martin Luther King Jr. famously said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." He may be right, but it doesn't bend itself. History doesn't make us, we make history. Its course is changed by the people themselves, who, with their values as a sextant, navigate daily moral quandaries. The choices we make define our direction and who we are. Right now, we face two momentous ones. The first, is a man fit or unfit to be president? And the second, are we worthy or unworthy of the blessings of liberty? One will be decided by ballot, and the other by our behaviors in the weeks, months, and years to come. I hope you will debate the answers beyond this book. If we look within ourselves and undertake the arduous task of moral repair, America can restore the soul of its political system. We can once again illuminate a pathway for others onto the vaunted plazas of open society. If, however, we shrink from the task, our names will be recorded by history as those who didn't pass the torch, but let its light expire. That is my warning. Every American generation before us faced and passed this test. Our charge is to do the same, proving that the United States can do what other civilizations could not, survive the ages, and bend the arc of the moral universe toward the value that is the real sinew of civic life: freedom. Let's roll. This has been a Hachette Audio production of A Warning, written by Anonymous, a senior Trump administration official. Read by Robert Fass. Produced by Michelle McGonigal. Directed by Charles McCrory. Recorded at Hachette Audio Studios. Post-production by Pete Pantelis. A Warning is also available in print and as an e-book from 12, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2019 by Anonymous. Audio production copyright 2019, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.